Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Wednesday, January 17th. We actually get to start today with the fact that there may be some surprising good news for a change coming out of Congress, especially for Americans with children, especially low-income families with children who, ironically, some of you know this, some of you experienced it, saw child poverty rates drop dramatically at the start of the pandemic, but have since gone back up. For more than a year now, Democrats in Congress have been trying to strike a deal with Republicans to revive the policy known as the child tax credit, or at least extend the child tax credit that still exists. In exchange, in a deal that is reportedly very close now to being struck, Republicans want to renew some corporate tax breaks that had recently expired themselves. Well, yesterday, two of the main lawmakers on tax issues, these are Senate Finance Chair Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, and House Ways and Means Chair Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri, announced the two parties, at least the leaderships, had struck a deal. Now, the new deal is, well, kind of the same as the one they had tried to pass over a year ago, at least the Democrats did. Democrats would get a limited version of a child tax credit in exchange for greater incentives for domestic research and development and faster depreciation of certain kinds of capital investments for business. I know that sounds wonky, but it affects a lot of people directly, and we'll explain. But by no means is this a done deal. What? You're talking about a deal? But it's not a done deal? Yeah, Congress has a tight deadline to implement any changes to the tax code that would be effective for the 2023 tax filing season, which is upon us from now until April 15th. So joining me now to break down the negotiations and who they stand to benefit is Dylan Matthews, senior correspondent and lead writer at Vox, who wrote an explainer on a lot of this. Dylan, thanks for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And we'll get into some of the specifics of the Wyden-Smith deal, named after those two lawmakers I mentioned in the intro. But first, what basically, for people who don't know, is the child tax credit?
So the child tax credit has had a long and sort of strange life. It began in 1997 as a middle-class tax cut that was agreed to by Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. Basically, Gingrich wanted to cut capital gains taxes for sort of wealthy people with investments who pay taxes on it. I think he was aware that it would look bad if he did that without doing anything for middle-class families. And so he and Clinton cut a deal on a credit that was just $400 for families that owed taxes and with children. And so it started there, and it was a very modest credit. And it's just continually expanded. It was expanded a little bit in the 2001 tax cuts by George W. Bush. It was expanded a lot in 2009 by Obama as part of the stimulus, and then that was extended. And it really was expanded pretty dramatically. It was doubled, actually, in 2017 under the Trump tax cuts to become sort of the main tax break for families with kids, but it always had a limitation that it was meant for families with earnings, and initially was meant for families that owed taxes, and that excluded a lot of people at the bottom. And we can get into what happened in 2021, but a lot of the fight on the Democratic side has been to take it from just being a tax break for middle class upper middle class families to one that actually targets the poor.
Yeah, do talk about what happened in 2021 or generally during the pandemic. Some regular listeners know we've had Congressman Richie Torres from the Bronx on the show several times talking about this. He represents the poorest, most low-income congressional district in America, and he said the impact of the pandemic-era child tax credit on poverty rates, child poverty rates in his district was dramatic. So talk about that.
Sure. And so one piece of international context that's useful to know here is that most countries around the world, rich countries, have what's called a child allowance. And so that's money that's paid to parents, usually without regard to income, for being parents. And the U.S. has never had this. And there's been an effort by anti-poverty advocates for a while to try to turn the child credit into this. By making it not based on income at all, sending it out monthly, just making it a regular check. And New York listeners might be interested to know that a lot of the effort behind the scenes was done by people in New York. Columbia has a lot of researchers who worked on this. There's a guy named David Harris, who's a New York-based philanthropist and activist, who I think is the real unsung hero of this. But they were able to persuade the Biden administration to include a measure in the 2021 stimulus. So this is the second year of the pandemic. Biden has just become president. They want to do a new round of stimulus checks to everybody. But activists on the outside and in Congress convince him to increase the child tax credit from $2,000 to up to $3,600 for parents of young kids and $3,000 for parents of older kids, and to make it what's called fully refundable. That might sound a little wonky, but it just means everybody gets it. No matter how poor you are. And it arranged for at least half the year for it to be sent out as a monthly check. So from July to December 2021, parents were getting checks in the mail as opposed to getting sort of a big lump sum in their tax return come March or April of the next year.
Yeah, that's different, the checks in the mail during the year, the monthly checks.
Absolutely, yeah. It changes how people interact with it, how they spend it. And it had a huge, huge impact I think child poverty fell quite dramatically. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but at least a third, maybe more like a half in that just that year. It's a little hard to parse out because a lot of things were happening in 2021, as listeners remember. Stimulus checks were going out. The economy was kind of returning. It was a really dramatic time. But I think poverty experts would agree that this measure was very targeted at people at the bottom and made a big difference. And then it went away.
If it had cut child poverty so dramatically, why did it go away? Why did they allow it to go away?
So I think it's worth underlining how dramatic a policy shift this was. In the 1990s, some listeners may remember, there was a huge fight over welfare reform. And what that fight was about was a program that gave cash to parents of children without an expectation that they work. And this was considered so controversial and so politically toxic for the Clinton administration that Clinton signed a bill that effectively eliminated that program. There's a lot of opposition. Pat Moynihan memorably said that we would be seeing children freezing to death on subway grates. We didn't see that, in part because the economy in the late 90s was really good. But I think people had internalized a lesson that you can't just give money for nothing. That's how Democrats lose. That's how Republicans get us, is that they point out welfare queens and other people they think are unfairly benefiting from this.
Just to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago and tie it together, so different than in other Western industrialized countries we like to compare ourselves to, where the idea of government checks to families with children as a fairly routine thing is not controversial, correct?
Absolutely. And I think also different from American history. The story of child benefits is also sort of the history of 20th century feminism, that the first programs we had like this were called mother's pensions, and they were passed in the 1920s for World War I widows. Because the assumption in the 20s was if you're a widow of someone who died in the war, and you have children, you shouldn't be expected to work because women generally didn't work. And so we'll give you money for nothing so that you don't work. And then eventually that program evolved. And by the 70s and 80s, the assumption was women should work, even if they're single parents. And so what was the point of the program in the beginning its major flaw in what it got attacked for. But to fast forward a bit to 2021, I think people thought we had moved past this, and I think activists thought we had sort of moved past welfare reform politics and could give people money for being parents. And I think they were over-optimistic. And there were people, I think Joe Manchin in the Senate most loudly, but I think a lot of people in the Democratic coalition thought this was going too fast, and that that they were not actually comfortable with setting up a program that looked like they were reviving cash welfare. And it became clear that extending it beyond 2021, there just weren't the votes. I think it was also a context of it was an emergency, and this had been passed as part of an emergency program. And that made it a little harder to extend, because if the initial argument was we need this because this is a unique moment, and then you're saying, well, I want to make it permanent. Well, was it a unique moment, or was this something that you want as a permanent policy?
Yeah. It's funny when you talk about how this ties to the history of feminism and the history of welfare reform. I mean, it wasn't that long ago in the, let's say, the post-Clinton years when they did away with that subsidy known as aid to families with dependent children that you were talking about before for low-income women, that traditional conservatives, we could call them traditionalist conservatives, were arguing this kind of paradoxical thing that these middle-class mothers who were out in the workforce in the name of feminism, they're abandoning their children and they should go back home. Right. So middle class women in the paid workforce should go back home. But low income women, especially single low income women, they should be forced to work mm-hmm. by government policy. What a paradox. But that's where we kind of landed. Or I guess we landed where just about everybody who wanted to and others who just needed to economically were going out to the workforce. But there was that paradox that was front and center in conservative ideology for a while.
Absolutely. And I think it both fed on and sort of revealed some cleavages within conservatism. So there's religious conservatives who care a lot about the traditional family. There's free market conservatives who want lower taxes, lower benefit programs. In aid to families with dependent children, they had an enemy they could both agree on, that it did have significant marriage penalties. It did sort of implicitly favor single mothers over partnered couples. And so traditional religious conservatives hated it for that reason. And it was a major benefit program. And so the free marketers hated it for that reason. But sometimes the alliance would come apart. There's an amazing book called American Dream by Jason DeParle that's a history of welfare reform that I recommend listeners check out. But one of the most remarkable moments in it is when Republicans in Congress want to pass a bill that would ban for life all government benefits to women who have a child before the age of 21. Just sort of a blanket ban on any benefits to teen or early 20s mothers. And they didn't pass it, not because of opposition that this was cruel or something, but because anti-abortion groups begged them to not pass it, because they understood that if you passed a law like that, it would lead to a surge in teen abortions.
So do you know how much this version is projected to lift kids out of poverty compared to what the studies found happened in 2021, which you said it cut child poverty from a third to a half, according to the experts?
Yeah, so this is not anywhere near that level of impact. I would my back of the envelope guess would be maybe a 5 to 10% decrease in child poverty. That's not nothing. That matters a lot to those kids. And I should also emphasize that when we're talking about reducing poverty, we're talking about the number of kids who go above a certain line. And going above that line really matters. But being closer to that line also matters. And there's millions more kids who will be less poor because they get this money, even if they're still below the poverty line. Their lives will be better. So it's significant, but it's not the credit that anti-poverty advocates and some Democrats have been fighting for a long time. It's right. It's very much a partial measure.
And that kind of implies a whole other conversation, which is why should anybody who works full time in the workforce, in the paid workforce, be under the poverty line? Why aren't the minimum wage laws, living wage laws, whatever we want to call them, enough to guarantee that if you have a full-time job, you are not in poverty in the United States? But that's a related but different discussion. Yeah. And so how many people fall through the cracks in this respect? You write about 2 in 5 American households owe $0 in income taxes or get money back on net. It reminds me of, you know, one of the reasons Mitt Romney lost the presidential election in 2012 to Barack Obama, because he got caught on tape saying that 47% of Americans were basically mooches because they made too little money to pay income taxes. That's similar to the 2 in 5 figure. That's 40% that you cite. So that is to say, enough people are poor in America that their federal income tax bill is zero, that it equals 40%?
Yeah. No, I think Mitt and I are getting that number from the exact same place, which is figures put out by the Tax Policy Center. It was 47% when he was talking. It's 40% now. I think part of what was ironic about him saying that is that I think Republicans deserve some degree of credit for that number being so high. One of the things the Trump tax credits did, for instance, is that they more than doubled the standard deduction. And so for a married couple now, you get a standard deduction of $27,700. I know this because I was working on my taxes earlier. And so if you earn less than that as a married couple, no income taxes. And then you can get credits on top of that, like the child credit. There are other deductions and things you can add. And that all put together results in a lot of people not owing. Another group to mention are retirees. Some Social Security benefits are taxable. A lot aren't. Some pensions are taxable. A lot aren't. If you have Roth savings, that's generally not taxable. And so all these measures, many of which were supported by Republicans as part of broader tax cut packages, have added up to a significant share of Americans not owing income taxes. I feel obliged to say here, many if not most of these people pay payroll taxes. Almost all of them pay sales taxes on a local right. level. Right. And so I think the implication of mooching is not fair. But it does raise questions about programs like the child tax credit and whether they should be limited to people who owe taxes if the share of people who don't is large and has risen a lot in recent decades.
So you've been comparing the United States to European countries in this respect, and we are lucky enough to be getting a call from Europe. Here is Mari in Switzerland. You're on WNYC. Hi, Mari.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm very interested in this topic because we are immigrants from the U.S. to Switzerland, and our family used to get a child tax credit for our daughter when she was living with us. She's now older than 18, and she moved back to the U.S., but for the 3 years she was here, we got money back from the government, and it is treated as totally normal and a great policy to encourage people to have kids and to make things a little bit easier for them. So I'm a fan.
Mari, thank you very much. Lisa in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, hello. I have a question for your guest about if there's any work being done for people in poverty, but just working people in general, about compensating parents for childcare. We know what that can cost when you have to pay for it. And do people ever talk about how many parents do the second shift, but they're not paid for that other job? Or they're adding a lot of value to the economy by taking care of kids, but we don't have a quantity or an amount of money for that.
Yeah, and that's why I'm always careful to use the language of women who work outside the home, or any parents who work outside the home or in the paid workforce, as opposed to just who work, because obviously it's unpaid work, but it is work to be home with kids. So, Dylan, what do you say?
Sure. And I think there's a long activist history behind the idea of wages for housework. Sylvia Federici, who's at Hofstra, is, I think, the scholar most associated with that idea. But it was a major movement among radical and Marxist feminists in the 1970s, and I think has a long and distinguished history. And I think some have thought of the child credit and child allowances as a way of implementing that. I think this does get into a debate that sometimes happens in national politics. There are some conservatives who are sort of sympathetic to ideas like a child allowance on sort of traditional family grounds, that they want to encourage people to have more kids. They want to support families with kids. So they're attracted to it. Those same people tend to be fairly hostile to direct subsidies for child care, for subsidies to child care centers, for nannies, for au pairs. Because they have a particular notion of what a family should look like and a particular model they want to promote. And they view subsidizing childcare outside the home as favoring one model of family over another, favoring working mothers over sort of working outside the house mothers ahead of stay-at-home mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's more room for bipartisan compromise when it comes to just giving cash directly to parents, regardless of their care situation. But it's also true that the amounts of money we're talking about for the child credit, we're talking about $2,000 a year maximum. That doesn't get you very far in a child care center in Brooklyn, say.
I said way back in the intro that even though this deal seems to have been struck between a leading Democrat and a leading Republican in Congress, it isn't done yet. And if I'm reading this right, they only have until the end of the month to get it passed so that it would apply to the 2023 tax year that people are now starting to fill out their taxes for. So what are the politics of this in Congress, and are there factions who might block it?
Sure. So I think there's a couple of forms of opposition we've seen. One is Republicans who don't care particularly about the business tax cuts and oppose the child credit changes. So I think we'll see some opposition from them. A more surprising angle is some sort of Democrats have criticized it for not going far enough or for giving too much to corporations and not enough to children. Rosa DeLauro, who has been a historically a big backer of the child credit, has signaled that she might oppose the bill on those grounds.
From Connecticut.
From Connecticut, represents New Haven. My very scientific view is that it maybe has a 50-50 shot. Congress has passed things that affect sort of ongoing tax years before, they did that in 2021 by changing how unemployment was treated. So it could happen. I can say I volunteer at a tax site where we do tax preparation for low income families, and we're all bracing for if it suddenly changes in the middle of our tax season. And while that might be a little more paperwork for us, it would be a win for our clients.
So something to watch between now and the end of the month in Congress. And we leave it there with Dylan Matthews, senior correspondent and lead writer at Vox. And now we know a volunteer for filling out tax returns for low-income families. Thanks so much for coming on, Dylan.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.